Blind Sight, Disc 3.
I swear, if the aliens end up eating the lot of us, we'll have the Church of Game Theory to thank for it, Sasha said. She was grabbing a brick of couscous from the galley. I was there for the caffeine. We were more or less alone. The rest of the crew was strewn from dome to fab. Linguists don't use it? I knew some that did. We don't. And the others are hacks. Thing about game theory is it assumes rational self-interest among the players. And people just aren't rational. It used to assume that, I allowed. These days they factor in the social neurology. Human social neurology. She bit a corner off her brick, spoke around a mouthful of semolina. That's what game theory's good for. Rational players or human ones. And let me take a wild stab here and wonder if either of those is going to apply to that. She waved her hand at some archetypal alien lurking past the bulkhead. It's got its limitations, I admitted. I guess you use the tools you can lay your hands on, Sasha snorted. So if you couldn't get your hands on a proper set of blueprints, you'd base your dream home on a book of dirty limericks. Maybe not. And then, a bit defensive in spite of myself, I added, I found it useful, though, in areas you might not expect it to be. Yeah? Name one. Birthdays, I said, and immediately wished I hadn't. Sasha stopped chewing. Something behind her eyes flickered, almost strobed, as if her other selves were pricking up their ears. Go on, she said, and I could feel the whole gang listening in. It's nothing, really. It's just an example. So, tell us. Sasha cocked James's head at me. I shrugged. No point making a big thing out of it. Well, according to game theory, you should never tell anyone when your birthday is. I don't follow. It's a lose-lose proposition. There's no winning strategy. What do you mean, strategy? It's a birthday. Chelsea had said exactly the same thing when I'd tried to explain it to her. Look, I'd said, say you tell everyone when it is and nothing happens. It's kind of a slap in the face. Or suppose they throw you a party, Chelsea had replied. Then you don't know whether they're doing it sincerely or if your earlier interaction just guilted them into observing an occasion they'd rather have ignored. But if you don't tell anyone, and nobody commemorates the event, there's no reason to feel badly, because after all, nobody knew. And if somebody does buy you a drink, then you know it's sincere, because nobody would go to all the trouble of finding out when your birthday is and then celebrating it if they didn't honestly like you. Of course, the gang was more up to speed on such things. I didn't have to explain it verbally. I could just grab a piece of consensus and plot out the payoff matrix. Tell, don't tell along the columns. Celebrated, not celebrated along the rows. The unassailable black and white logic of cost and benefit in the squares themselves. The math was irrefutable. The one winning strategy was concealment. Only fools revealed their birthdays. Sasha looked at me. You ever show this to anyone else? Sure, my girlfriend. Her eyebrows lifted. You had a girlfriend? A real one? I nodded. Once. You mean after you showed this to her? Well, yes. Uh-huh. Her eyes wandered back to the payoff matrix. Just curious, Siri. How did she react? She didn't, really. Not at first, then, well, she laughed. Better woman than me, Sasha shook her head. I'd have dumped you on the spot.
My nightly constitutional up the spine. Glorious, dreamy flight along a single degree of freedom. I sailed through hatches and corridors, threw my arms wide and spun in the gentle cyclonic breezes of the drum. Bates ran circles around me, bouncing her ball against bins and bulkheads, stretching to feel each curving rebound in the torqued pseudograv. The toy ricocheted off a stairwell and out of reach as I passed. The major's curses followed me through the needle's eye, from crypt to bridge. I braked just short of the dome, stopped by the sound of quiet voices from ahead. "Of course they're beautiful," Spindle murmured. "They're stars." "And I'm guessing I'm not your first choice to share the view," James said. "You're a close second, but I've got a date with Mish." "She never mentioned it." "She doesn't tell you everything. Ask her." "Hey, this body's taking its antilibs, even if yours isn't. Mind out of the gutter, Suze. Eros is only one kind of love, eh? Ancient Greeks recognized four." "Right. Definitely not Susan, not anymore. Figures you'd take your lead from a bunch of sodomites. Fuck, Sasha. All I'm asking is a few minutes alone with Mish before the whip starts cracking again. My body too, Ike. You want to pull your eyes over my wool? I just want to talk, eh? Alone. That too much to ask?" I heard Sasha take a breath. I heard Michelle let it out. "Sorry, kid. You know the gang. Thank God. It's like some group inspection whenever I come looking for FaceTime. I guess you're lucky they like you then. I still say you ought to stage a coup. You could always move in with us." I heard the rustle of bodies and gentle contact. "How are you?" Spindle asked. "You okay?" "Pretty good. I think I'm finally used to being alive again. You?" "Hey, I'm a spaz no matter how long I've been dead." "You get the job done." "Why, merci. I try." A small silence. Theseus hummed quietly to herself. "Mom was right," Michelle said. "They are beautiful." "What do you see when you look at them?" And then catching himself. "I mean, they're prickly," Michelle told him. "When I turn my head, it's like bands of very fine needles rolling across my skin in waves. But it doesn't hurt at all. It just tingles. It's almost electric. It's nice." "Wish I could feel it that way." "You've got the interface. Just patch a camera into your parietal lobe instead of your visual cortex. That'd just tell me how a machine feels vision, eh? Still wouldn't know how you do." "Isaac Spindle, you're a romantic." "Nah." "You don't want to know. You want to keep it mysterious." "Already got more than enough mystery to deal with out here, in case you hadn't noticed." "Yeah, but we can't do anything about that." "That'll change. We'll be working our asses off in no time." "You think?" "Count on it," Spindle said. "So far we've just been peeking from a distance, eh? Bet all kinds of interesting stuff happens when we get in there and start poking with a stick." "Maybe for you, there's got to be a biological somewhere in the mix with all those organics." "Damn right. And you'll be talking to them while I'm giving them their physicals." "Maybe not. I mean, Mom would never admit it in a million years, but you had a point about language. When you get right down to it, it's a workaround, like trying to describe dreams with smoke signals. It's noble. It's maybe the most noble thing a body can do, but you can't turn a sunset into a string of grunts without losing something. It's limiting. Maybe whatever's out here doesn't even use it."
"Bet they do, though."
"Since when?" "You're the one who's always pointing out how inefficient language is."
"Only when I'm trying to get under your skin. Your pants, whole other thing." He laughed at his own joke. "Seriously, what are they going to use instead? Telepathy? I say you'll be up to your elbows in hieroglyphics before you know it. And what's more, you'll decode him in record time."
"You're sweet. But I wonder, half the time I can't even decode Yuka."
Michelle fell silent a moment.
"He actually kind of throws me sometimes."
"You and 7 billion others."
"Yeah, I know it's silly, but when he's not around, there's a part of me that can't stop wondering where he's hiding. And when he's right there in front of me,
I feel like I should be hiding.
Not his fault he creeps us out.
I know, but it's hardly a big morale booster. What genius came up with the idea of putting a vampire in charge?
Where else are you going to put him, eh? You want to be the one giving orders to him?
And it's not just the way he moves. It's the way he talks. It's just wrong.
You know, I'm not talking about the present tense thing or all the glottals.
Well, you know how he talks. He's terse.
It's efficient.
It's artificial, Isaac. He's smarter than all of us put together, but sometimes he talks like he's got a 50-word vocabulary.
A soft snort.
It's not like it'd kill him to use an adverb once in a while.
Ah, but you say that because you're a linguist, and you can't see why anyone wouldn't want to wallow in the sheer beauty of language. Spindle harrumphed with mock pomposity.
Now me, I'm a biologist, so it makes perfect sense.
Really? Then explain it to me, O wise and powerful mutilator of frogs.
Simple. Bloodsucker's a transient, not a resident.
Oh, those are killer whales, right? Whistle dialects?
I said forget the language, think about the lifestyle. Residents are fish eaters, eh? They hang out in big groups, don't move around much, talk all the time.
I heard a whisper of motion. Imagine Spindle leaning in and laying a hand on Michelle's arm. I imagine the sensors in his gloves telling him what she felt like.
Transients now, they eat mammals, seals, sea lions, smart prey. Smart enough to take cover when they hear a fluke slap or a click train. So transients are sneaky, eh? Hunt in small groups, range all over the place, keep their mouths shut so nobody hears them coming.
And Yuka's a transient. Man's instincts tell him to keep quiet around prey. Every time he opens his mouth, every time he lets us see him, he's fighting his own brain stem.
Maybe we shouldn't be so harsh on the old guy just because he's not the world's best motivational speaker, eh?
He's fighting the urge to eat us every time we have a briefing? That's reassuring.
Spindle chuckled.
It's probably not that bad. I guess even killer whales let their guard down after making a kill. Why sneak around on a full stomach, eh?
So he's not fighting his brainstem? He just isn't hungry.
Probably a little of both. Brainstem never really goes away, you know. But I'll tell you one thing.
Some of the playfulness ebbed from Spindle's voice.
I got no problem if Saresti wants to run the occasional briefing from his quarters. But the moment we stop seeing him altogether, that's when you start watching your back. Looking back, I can finally admit it. I envied Spindle his way with the ladies. Spliced and diced, a gangly mass of ticks and jitters that could barely feel his own skin, somehow he managed to be charming. That's the word, charming. As a social necessity, it was all but obsolete, fading into irrelevance along with the two-party non-virtual sex pairing. But even I'd tried one of those, and it would have been nice to have had Spindle's self-deprecating skill set to call on. Especially when everything with Chelsea started falling apart. I had my own style, of course. I tried to be charming in my own peculiar way. Once, after one too many fights about honesty and emotional manipulation, I'd started to think maybe a touch of whimsy might smooth things over. I had come to suspect that Chelsea just didn't understand sexual politics. Sure, she'd edited brains for a living, but maybe she'd just memorized all that circuitry without giving any thought to how it had arisen in the first place, to the ultimate rules of natural selection that had shaped it. Maybe she honestly didn't know that we were evolutionary enemies, that all relationships were doomed to failure. If I could slip that insight into her head, if I could charm my way past her defenses, maybe we'd be able to hold things together. So I thought about it, and I came up with the perfect way to raise her awareness. I wrote her a bedtime story, a disarming blend of humor and affection, and I called it The Book of Oogenesis. In the beginning were the gametes, and though there was sex, lo, there was no gender, and life was in balance. And God said, Let there be sperm. And some seeds did shrivel in size and grow cheap to make, and they did flood the market. And God said, Let there be eggs. And other seeds were afflicted by a plague of sperm. And yea, few of them bore fruit, for sperm brought no food for the zygote, and only the largest eggs could make up the shortfall. And these grew yet larger in the fullness of time. And God put the eggs into a womb, and said, Wait here, for thy bulk has made thee unwieldy, and sperm must seek thee out in thy chambers. Henceforth shalt thou be fertilized internally. And it was so. And God said to the gametes, The fruit of thy fusion may abide in any place and take any shape. It may breathe air or water or the sulphurous muck of hydrothermal vents. But do not forget my one commandment unto you, which has not changed from the beginning of time. Spread thy genes. And thus did sperm and egg go into the world. And sperm said, I am cheap and plentiful, and if sowed abundantly, I will surely fulfill God's plan. I shall forever seek out new mates, and then abandon them when they are with child, for there are many wombs, and little time. But egg said, Lo, the burden of procreation weighs heavily upon me. I must carry flesh that is but half mine, gestate and feed it even when it leaves my chamber. For by now many of egg's bodies were warm of blood, and furry besides. I can have but few children, and must devote myself to those, and protect them at every turn. And I will make sperm help me, for he got me into this, and though he doth struggle at my side, I shall not let him stray, nor lie with my competitors. And sperm liked this not. And God smiled, for its commandment had put sperm and egg at war with each other, even unto the day they made themselves obsolete. I brought her flowers one dusky Tuesday evening when the light was perfect. I pointed out the irony of that romantic old tradition, the severed genitalia of another species offered as precopulatory bribe, and then I recited my story just as we were about to fuck. To this day, I still don't know what went wrong. The glass ceiling is in you. The glass ceiling is conscience. Jacob Holtzbrinck, The Keys to the Planet. There were stories, before we left Earth, of a fourth wave. A fleet of deep space dreadnoughts running silent in our wake, should the cannon fodder up front run into something nasty. Or, if the aliens were friendly, an ambassadorial frigate full of politicians and CEOs ready to elbow their way to the front of the line. Never mind that Earth had no deep space dreadnoughts or ambassadorial spaceships. Theseus hadn't existed either before Firefall. Nobody had told us of any such contingent, but you never show the big picture to your front line. The less they know, the less they can betray. I still don't know if the fourth wave ever existed. I never saw any evidence of one, for whatever that's worth. We might have left them floundering back at Burns Caulfield. Or maybe they followed us all the way to Big Ben, crept just close enough to see what we were up against, and turned tail before things got ugly. I wonder if that's what happened. I wonder if they made it back home. I look back now, and hope not. A giant marshmallow kicked Theseus in the side. Down swung like a pendulum. Across the drum, Spindle yelped as if scalded. In the galley, cracking a bulb of hot coffee, I nearly was. This is it, I thought. We got too close. They're hitting back. What the? A flicker on the party line as Bates linked from the bridge. Main drive just kicked in. We're changing course. To what? Where? Whose orders? Mine, Saresti said, appearing above us. Nobody spoke. Drifting into the drum through the stern hatchway, the sound of something grinding. I pinged Theseus's resource allocation stack. Fabrication was retooling itself for the mass production of doped ceramics. Radiation shielding. Solid stuff, bulky and primitive, not the controlled magnetic fields we usually relied on. The gang emerged sleepy-eyed from their tent, Sasha grumbling, "What the fuck?"
"Watch." Sarosti took hold of consensus and shook it. It was a blizzard, not a briefing. Gravity wells and orbital trajectories, shear stress simulations in thunderheads of ammonium and hydrogen, stereoscopic planetscapes buried under filters ranging from gamma to radio. I saw breakpoints and saddle points and unstable equilibria. I saw fold catastrophes plotted in five dimensions. My augment strained to rotate the information. My meaty half-brain struggled to understand the bottom line. Something was hiding down there, in plain sight. Ben's accretion belt still wasn't behaving. Its delinquency wasn't obvious. Sarosti hadn't had to plot every pebble and mountain and planetesimal to find the pattern, but he'd come close. And neither he nor the conjoined intelligence he shared with the captain had been able to explain those trajectories as the mere aftermath of some past disturbance. The dust wasn't just settling. Some of it marched downhill to the beat of something that even now reached out from the cloud tops and pulled debris from orbit. Not all that debris seemed to hit. Ben's equatorial regions flickered constantly with the light of meteorite impacts, much fainter than the bright wakes of the skimmers, and gone in the wink of an eye. But those frequency distributions didn't quite account for all the rocks that had fallen. It was almost as though, every now and then, some piece of incoming detritus simply vanished into a parallel universe. Or got caught by something in this one. Something that circled Ben's equator every 40 hours, almost low enough to graze the atmosphere. Something that didn't show up in visible light, or infrared, or radar. Something that might have remained pure hypothesis if a skimmer hadn't burned an incandescent trail across the atmosphere behind it when Theseus happened to be watching. Sarosti threw that one dead center. A bright contrail streaking diagonally across Ben's perpetual nightscape, stuttering partway a degree or two to the left, stuttering back just before it passed from sight. Freeze frame showed a beam of light frozen solid, a segment snapped from its midsection and jiggled just a hair out of alignment. A segment 9 kilometers long. "It's cloaked," Sasha said, impressed. "Not very well." Bates emerged from the forward hatch and sailed spinward. "Pretty obvious refractory artifact." She caught stairs halfway to the deck, used the torque of spin against spam to flip upright and plant her feet on the steps. "Why didn't we catch that before?" "No backlight," Spindle suggested. "It's not just the contrail. Look at the clouds." Sure enough, Ben's cloudy backdrop showed the same subtle dislocation. Bates stepped onto the deck and headed for the conference table. "We should have seen this earlier." "The other probes see no such artifact," Sarosti said. "This probe approaches from a wider angle, 27 degrees. "Wider angle to what?" Sasha said. "To the line," Bates murmured. "Between us and them." It was all there on tactical. Theseus fell inward along an obvious arc, but the probes we'd dispatched hadn't dicked around with Hohmann transfers. They'd burned straight down, their courses barely bending, all within a few degrees of the theoretical line connecting Ben to Theseus. Except this one. This one had come in wide and seen the trickery.
"The farther from our bearing, the more obvious the discontinuity," Sarosti intoned. "Think it's clearly visible on any approach perpendicular to ours."
"So we're in a blind spot? We see it if we change course?" Bates shook her head. "The blind spot's moving, Sasha. It's
tracking us?"
Sasha sucked breath between her teeth.
"Motherfucker."
Spindle twitched. So what is it? Our skimmer factory?
The freeze frame's pixels began to crawl. Something emerged, granular and indistinct, from the turbulent swirls and curlicues of Ben's atmosphere. There were curves and spikes and no smooth edges. I couldn't tell how much of the shape was real and how much a fractal intrusion of underlying cloudscape. But the overall outline was that of a torus, or perhaps a collection of smaller jagged things piled together in a rough ring. And it was big. Those 9 clicks of displaced contrail had merely grazed the perimeter, cut across an arc of 40 or 50 degrees. This thing hiding in the shadow of 10 Jupiters was almost 30 kilometers from side to side. Sometime during Saraste's executive summary, we'd stopped accelerating. Down was back where it belonged. We weren't, though. Our hesitant maybe, maybe not approach was a thing of the past. We vectored straight in now, and damned the torpedoes.
That's 30 clicks across, Sasha pointed out. And it's invisible? Shouldn't we maybe be a little more cautious now?
Spindle shrugged.
If we could second-guess vampires, we wouldn't need vampires, eh?
A new facet bloomed on the feed. Frequency histograms and harmonic spectra erupted from flatline into shifting mountainscapes, a chorus of visible light.
Modulated laser, Bates reported.
Spindle looked up.
From that?
Bates nodded. Right after we blow its cover.
Interesting timing.
Scary timing, Spindle said.
How'd it know?
We changed course. We're heading right for it. The lightscape played on, knocking at the window.
Whatever it is, Bates said, it's talking to us.
Well then, remarked a welcome voice, by all means, let's say hello. Susan James was back in the driver's seat. I was the only pure spectator. They all performed what duties they could. Spindle ran Saraste's sketchy silhouette through a series of filters, perchance to squeeze a bit of biology from engineering. Bates compared morphometrics between the cloaked artifact and the skimmers. Saraste watched us all from overhead and thought vampire thoughts deeper than anything we could aspire to. But it was all just make-work. The gang of 4 was on center stage, under the capable direction of Susan James. She grabbed the nearest chair, sat, raised her hands as if cueing an orchestra. Her fingers trembled in midair as she played virtual icons. Her lips and jaw twitched with subvocal commands. I tapped her feed and saw text accreting around the alien signal. Rorschach to vessel approaching 116 degrees azimuth, 23 degrees declination relative. Hello, Theseus. Rorschach to vessel approaching 116 degrees azimuth, 23 degrees declination relative. Hello, Theseus. Rorschach to vessel approach. She decoded the damn thing. Already. She was even answering it. Theseus to Rorschach. Hello, Rorschach.
Hello, Theseus. Welcome to the neighborhood.
She'd had less than 3 minutes. Or rather, they'd had less than 3 minutes. 4 fully conscious hub personalities and a few dozen unconscious semiotic modules, all working in parallel, all exquisitely carved from the same lump of gray matter. I could almost see why someone would do such deliberate violence to their own minds, if it resulted in this kind of performance. Up to now, I had never fully convinced myself that even survival was sufficient cause. Request permission to approach, the gang sent. Simple and straightforward. Just facts and data, thank you, with as little room as possible for ambiguity and misunderstanding. Fancy sentiments like, we come in peace, could wait. A handshake was not the time for cultural exchange.
You should stay away. Seriously. This place is dangerous.
That got some attention. Bates and Spindle hesitated momentarily in their own headspaces
and glanced into James's. "Request information on danger," the gang sent back, still keeping it concrete. "Too close and dangerous to you. Low orbit complications." "Request information on low orbit complications." "Lethal environment. Rocks and rads." "You're welcome. I can take it, but we're like that." "We are aware of rocks in low orbit. We are equipped to deal with radiation. Request information on other hazards." I dug under the transcript to the channel it fed from. Theseus had turned part of the incoming beam into a sound wave, according to the color code. Vocal communication, then. They spoke. Waiting behind that icon were the raw sounds of an alien language. Of course, I couldn't resist. "Any time between friends, right? Are you here for the celebration?" English. The voice was human. Male. Old. "We are here to explore," replied the gang, although their voice was pure Theseus. "Request dialogue with agents who sent objects into near solar space." "First contact. Sounds like something to celebrate." I double-checked the source. No, this wasn't a translation. This was the actual unprocessed signal coming from Rorschach, it had called itself. Part of the signal, anyway. There were other elements, non-acoustic ones, encoded in the beam. I browsed them while James said, "Request information about your celebration. Standard ship-to-ship handshaking protocols." "You're interested." The voice was stronger now, younger. "Yes?" "You are?" "Yes," the gang repeated patiently. "You are?" The slightest hesitation. "This is Theseus." "I know that baseline. In Mandarin now. Who are you?" No obvious change in the harmonics. Somehow, though, the voice seemed to have acquired an edge. "This is Susan James. I am a—" "You wouldn't be happy here, Susan. Fetishistic religious beliefs involved. There are dangerous observances." James chewed her lip. "Request clarification. Are we in danger from these observances?"
"You certainly could be."
"Request clarification. Is it the observances that are dangerous, or the low orbit environment?"
"The environment of the disturbances. You should pay attention, Susan. Inattention connotes indifference," Rorschach said. "Or disrespect," it added after a moment.
We had 4 hours before Ben got in the way. 4 hours of uninterrupted non-stop communication made vastly easier than anyone had expected. It spoke our language, after all. Repeatedly, it expressed polite concern for our welfare. And yet, for all its facility with human speech, it told us very little. For 4 hours, it managed to avoid giving a straight answer on any subject beyond the extreme inadvisability of closer contact, and by the time it fell into eclipse, we still didn't know why. Saristi dropped onto the deck halfway through the exchange, his feet never touching the stairs. He reached out and grabbed a railing to steady himself on landing and staggered only briefly. If I'd tried that, I'd have ended up bouncing along the deck like a pebble in a cement mixer. He stood still as stone for the rest of the session, face motionless, eyes hidden behind his onyx visor. When Rorschach's signal faded in mid-sentence, he assembled us around the commons table with a gesture.
"It talks," he said.
James nodded. "It doesn't say much, except for asking us to keep our distance. So far the voice has manifested as adult male, although the apparent age changed a few times." He'd heard all that.
"Structure?"
"The ship-to-ship protocols are perfect. Its vocabulary is far greater than you could derive from standard nav chatter between a few ships, so they've been listening to all our in-system traffic, I'd say for several years at least.
On the other hand, the vocabulary doesn't have anywhere near the range you'd get by monitoring entertainment multimede, so they probably arrived after the broadcast age.
How well do they use the vocabulary they have?
They're using phrase structure grammar, long-distance dependencies, FLN recursion at least 4 levels deep, and I see no reason why it won't go deeper with continued contact. They're not parrots, Yuka. They know the rules. That name, for example.
Rorschach, Bates muttered, knuckles cracking as she squeezed her pet ball. Interesting choice.
I checked the registry. There's an ICANN freighter named Rorschach on the Martian Loop. Whoever we're talking to must regard their own platform the way we'd regard a ship, and picked one of our names to fit.
Spindle dropped into the chair beside me, fresh from a galley run. A bulb of coffee glistened like gelatin in his hand.
That name? Out of all the ships in the Intersys? Seems way too symbolic for a random choice.
I don't think it was random. Unusual ship names provoke comment. Rorschach's pilot goes ship to ship with some other vessel. The other vessel comes back with, "Oh, Grandma, what an unusual name you have." Rorschach replies with some off-the-cuff comment about nomenclatural origins, and it all goes out in the EM. Someone listening to all that chatter not only figures out the name and the thing it applies to, but can get some sense of meaning from the context.
Our alien friends probably eavesdropped on half the registry and deduced that Rorschach would be a better tag for something unfamiliar than, say, the SS Jamie Matthews.
Territorial and smart, Spindle grimaced, conjuring a mug from beneath his chair.
Wonderful. Bates shrugged.
Territorial, maybe. Not necessarily aggressive. In fact, I wonder if they could hurt us even if they wanted to.
I don't, Spindle said.
Those skimmers, the Major waved a dismissive hand. Big ships turn slowly. If they were setting up to snooker us, we'd see it well in advance.
She looked around the table. Look, am I the only one who finds this odd? An interstellar technology that redecorates super Jovians and lines up meteoroids like elephants on parade, and they were hiding from us?
Unless there's someone else out here? James suggested uneasily.
Bates shook her head. The cloak was directional. It was aimed at us and no one else.
And even we saw through it, Spindle added.
Exactly. So they go to Plan B, which so far amounts to nothing but bluster and vague warnings. I'm just saying, they're not acting like giants. Rorschach's behavior feels improvised. I don't think they expected us.
Of course not. Burns Caulfield was, I don't think they expected us yet.
Oh, Spindle said, digesting it. The Major ran one hand over her naked scalp. Why would they expect us to just give up after we've learned we've been sniped? Of course we'd look elsewhere. Burns Caulfield could only have been intended as a delaying action. If I was them, I'd plan on us getting out here eventually. But I think they miscalculated somehow. We got out here sooner than they expected and caught them with their pants down.
Spindle split the bulb and emptied it into his mug.
Pretty large miscalculation for something so smart, eh?
A hologram bloomed on contact with the steaming liquid, glowing in soft commemoration of the Gaza glasslands. The scent of plasticized coffee flooded the commons.
Especially after they'd surveilled us down to the square meter, he added. And what did they see? ICANNs, solar sails, ships that take years to reach the Kuiper and don't have the reserves to go anywhere else afterwards. Telematter didn't exist beyond Boeing's simulators and a half dozen prototypes back then. Easy to miss. They must have figured one decoy would buy them all the time they needed.
To do what? James wondered.
Whatever it is, Bates said, we're ringside.
Spindle raised his mug with an infirm hand and sipped. The coffee trembled in its prison, the surface wobbling and blobbing in the drum's half-hearted gravity.
James pursed her lips in faint disapproval. Open-topped containers for liquids were technically verboten in variable gravity environments, even for people without Spindle's dexterity issues.
"So they're bluffing," Spindle said at last.
Bates nodded. "That's my guess. Rorschach's still under construction. We could be dealing with an automated system of some kind."
"So we can ignore the keep off the grass signs, eh? Walk right in."
"We can afford to bide our time. We can afford to not push it."
"Ah, so even though we could maybe handle it now, you want to wait until it graduates from covert to invulnerable?"
Spindle shuddered, set down his coffee.
"Where'd you get your military training again? Sporting Chance Academy?"
Bates ignored the jibe. "The fact that Rorschach's still growing may be the best reason to leave it alone for a while. We don't have any idea what the mature form of this artifact might be. Sure, it hid. Lots of animals take cover from predators without being predators, especially young ones. Sure, it's evasive, doesn't give us the answers we want, but maybe it doesn't know them. Did you consider that? How much luck would you have interrogating a human embryo? Adult could be a whole different animal.
Adult could put our asses through a meat grinder."
"So could the embryo, for all we know." Bates rolled her eyes. "Jesus, Isaac, you're the biologist. I shouldn't have to tell you how many shy, reclusive critters pack a punch when they're cornered. Porcupine doesn't want any trouble, but he'll still give you a face full of quills if you ignore the warning." Spindle said nothing. He slid his coffee sideways along the concave tabletop to the very limit of his reach. The liquid sat there in its mug, a dark circle perfectly parallel to the rim, but canted slightly toward us. I even thought I could make out the merest convexity in the surface itself. Spindle smiled faintly at the effect. James cleared her throat. "Not to downplay your concerns, Isaac, but we've hardly exhausted the diplomatic route, and at least it's willing to talk, even if it's not as forthcoming as we'd like."
"Sure, it talks," Spindle said, eyes still on the leaning mug. "Not like us."
"Well, no, there's some, it's not just slippery, it's downright dyslexic sometimes, you noticed? And it mixes up its pronouns. Given that it picked up the language entirely via passive eavesdropping, it's remarkably fluent. In fact, from what I can tell, they're more efficient at processing speech than we are."
"Gotta be efficient at a language if you're gonna be so evasive in it, eh?"
"If they were human, I might agree with you," James replied. "But what appears to us as evasion or deceit could just as easily be explained by a reliance on smaller conceptual units."
"Conceptual units?"
Bates, I was beginning to realize, never pulled up a subtitle if she could help it. James nodded. "Like processing a line of text word by word instead of looking at complete phrases. The smaller the units, the faster they can be reconfigured. It gives you very fast semantic reflexes. The downside is that it's difficult to maintain the same level of logical consistency since the patterns within the larger structure are more likely to get shuffled."
"Whoa!"
Spindle straightened, all thoughts of liquids and centripetal force forgotten. "All I'm saying is, we aren't necessarily dealing with deliberate deception here. An entity who parses information at one scale might not be aware of inconsistencies on another. It might not even have conscious access to that level."
"That's not all you're saying."
"Isaac, you can't apply human norms to a...
I wondered what you were up to."
Spindle dove into the transcripts. A moment later, he dredged up an excerpt. "Request information on environments you consider lethal. Request information on your response to the prospect of imminent exposure to lethal environments."
"Glad to comply. But your lethal is different from us. There are many mitigating circumstances."
"You were testing it," Spindle crowed. He smacked his lips, his jaw ticked. "You were looking for an emotional response."
"It was just a thought. It didn't prove anything."
"Was there a difference in the response time?"
James hesitated, then shook her head.
"But it was a stupid idea.
There are so many variables. We have no idea how they... I mean, they're alien. The pathology's classic.
What pathology? I asked.
It doesn't mean anything except that they're different from the human baseline, James insisted, which is not something anyone here can look down their nose about.
I tried again.
What pathology?
James shook her head.
Spindle filled me in. There's a syndrome you might have heard about, eh? Fast talkers, no conscience, tend to malapropism and self-contradiction, no emotional affect.
We're not talking about human beings here, James said again softly.
But if we were, Spindle added, we might call Rorschach a clinical sociopath.
Saresti had said nothing during this entire exchange. Now, with the word hanging out in the open, I noticed that nobody else would look at him. We all knew that Yuka Saresti was a sociopath, of course. Most of us just didn't mention it in polite company. Spindle was never that polite. Or maybe it was just that he seemed to almost understand Saresti. He could look behind the monster and regard the organism, no less a product of natural selection for all the human flesh it had devoured in eons past. That perspective calmed him somehow. He could watch Saresti watching him and not flinch.
I feel sorry for the poor son of a bitch, he said once, back in training.
Some would have thought that absurd. This man, so massively interfaced with machinery that his own motor skills had degraded for want of proper care and feeding, this man who heard X-rays and saw in shades of ultrasound, so corrupted by retrofits he could no longer even feel his own fingertips without assistance, this man could pity anyone else, let alone an infra-eyed predator built to murder without the slightest twitch of remorse?
Empathy for sociopaths isn't common, I remarked. Maybe it should be. We, at least, he waved an arm, some remote-linked sensor cluster across the simulator whirred and torqued reflexively, chose the add-ons. Vampires had to be sociopaths. They're too much like their own prey. A lot of taxonomists don't even consider them a subspecies, you know that? Never diverged far enough for reproductive isolation. So maybe they're more syndrome than race. Just a bunch of obligate cannibals with a consistent set of deformities.
And how does that make, if the only thing you can eat is your own kind, empathy is going to be the first thing that goes?
Psychopathy's no disorder in those shoes, eh?
Just a survival strategy. But they still make our skin crawl, so we chain them up.
You think we should have repaired the crucifix glitch? Everyone knew why we hadn't. Only a fool would resurrect a monster without safeguards in place. Vampires came with theirs built in. Without his anti-Euclideans, Saresti would go grand mal the first time he caught close sight of a four-panel window frame.
But Spindle was shaking his head. We couldn't have fixed it. Or we could have, he amended. But the glitch is in the visual cortex, eh? Linked to their omnisavantism. You fix it, you disable their pattern-matching skills, and then what's the point in even bringing them back?
I didn't know that.
Well, that's the official story.
He fell silent a moment, cracked a crooked grin.
Then again, we didn't have any trouble fixing the protocahedron pathways when it suited us.
I subtitled, Context-Sensitive, Consensus Served Up, Protocahedron Gamma Y, the magical hominid brain protein that vampires had never been able to synthesize. The reason they hadn't just switched to zebras or warthogs once denied human prey. Why our discovery of the terrible secret of the right angle had spelled their doom.
Anyway, I just think he's cut off.
A nervous tick tugged at the corner of Spindle's mouth.
Lone wolf, nothing but sheep for company. Wouldn't you feel lonely?
They don't like company, I reminded him. You didn't put vampires of the same sex together, not unless you were taking bets on a bloodbath. They were solitary hunters and very territorial.
With a minimum viable pred-prey ratio of 1 to 10, and human prey spread so sparsely across the Pleistocene landscape, the biggest threat to their survival had been competition from their own kind. Natural selection had never taught them to play nicely together. That didn't cut any ice with Spindle, though. "Doesn't mean he can't be lonely," he insisted. "Just means he can't fix it." They know the words, but not the music. Robert Hare, Without Conscience. We did it with mirrors. Great round parabolic things, each impossibly thin and three times as high as a man. Theseus rolled them up and bolted them to firecrackers stuffed with precious antimatter from our dwindling stockpiles. With 12 hours to spare, she flung them like confetti along precise ballistic trajectories, and when they were safely distant, she set them alight. They pinwheeled off every which way, gamma sleeting in their wake until they burned dry. Then they coasted, unfurling mercurial insect wings across the void. In the greater distance, 400,000 alien machines looped and burned and took no obvious notice. Rorschach fell around Ben, barely 1,500 kilometers from atmosphere, a fast, endless circle that took just under 40 hours to complete. By the time it didn't return to our sight, the mirrors were all outside the zone of total blindness. A close-up of Ben's equatorial edge floated in consensus. Mirror icons sparkled around it like an exploding schematic, like the disconnected facets of some great expanding compound eye. None had breaks. Whatever high ground the mirrors held, they wouldn't hold it for long. "There," Bates said. A mirage wavered stage left, a tiny spot of swirling chaos perhaps half the size of a fingernail held at arm's length. It told us nothing. It was pure heat shimmer, but light bounced toward us from dozens of distant relayers, and while each saw scarcely more than our last probe had, a patch of dark cloud set slightly awry by some invisible prism, each of those views refracted differently. The captain sieved flashes from the heavens and stitched them into a composite view. Details emerged. First, a faint sliver of shadow, a tiny dimple all but lost in the seething equatorial cloud banks. It had just barely rotated into view around the edge of the disk. A rock in the stream, perhaps, an invisible finger stuck in the clouds, turbulence and sheer stress shredding the boundary layers to either side. Spindle squinted. "Plage effect." Subtitles said he was talking about a kind of sunspot, a knot in Ben's magnetic field. "Higher," James said. "Something floated above that dimple in the clouds, the way a ground effect ocean liner floats above the depression it pushes into the water's surface." I zoomed. Next to an Owasa subdwarf with 10 times the mass of Jupiter, Rorschach was tiny. Next to Theseus, it was a colossus. Not just a torus, but a tangle, a city-sized chaos of spun glass, loops and bridges and attenuate spires. The surface texture was pure artifice, of course. Consensus merely gift-wrapped the enigma in refracted background. Still, in some dark, haunting way, it was almost beautiful. A nest of obsidian snakes and smoky crystal spines. "It's talking again," James reported.
"Talk back," Sarasti said, "and abandoned us."
So she did, and while the gang spoke with the artifact, the others spied upon it. Their vision failed over time. Mirrors fell away along their respective vectors, lines of sight degraded with each passing second,
but consensus filled with things learned in the meantime. Rorschach massed 1.8 times 10 to the 10th power kilograms within a total volume of 2.3 times 10 to the 8th power cubic meters. Its magnetic field, judging by radio squeals and its Plage effect, was thousands of times stronger than the Sun's. Astonishingly, parts of the composite image were clear enough to discern fine spiral grooves twined around the structure. Fibonacci sequence, Spindle reported, one jiggling eye fixing me for a moment. At least they're not completely alien. Spheroid protuberances disfigured the tips of at least three of Rorschach's innumerable spines. The grooves were more widely spaced in those areas, like skin grown tight and swollen with infection. Just before one vital mirror sailed out of range, it glimpsed another spine, split a third of the way along its length. Torn material floated flaccid and unmoving in vacuum. "Please," Bates said softly, "tell me that's not what it looks like." Spindle grinned. "Sporangium? Seed pod? Why not?" Rorschach may have been reproducing, but beyond a doubt it was growing, fed by a steady trickle of infalling debris from Ben's accretion belt. We were close enough now to get a clear view of that procession. Rocks and mountains and pebbles fell like sediment swirling around a drain. Particles that collided with the artifact simply stuck. Rorschach engulfed prey like some vast metastatic amoeba. The acquired mass was apparently processed internally and shunted to apical growth zones. Judging by infinitesimal changes in the artifact's allometry, it grew from the tips of its branches. The procession never stopped. Rorschach was insatiable. It was a strange attractor in the interstellar gulf. The paths along which the rocks fell were precisely and utterly chaotic. It was as though some Keplerian black belt had set up the whole system like an astronomical wind-up toy, kicked everything into motion, and let inertia do the rest. "Didn't think that was possible," Bates said. Spindle shrugged. "Hey, chaotic trajectories are just as deterministic as any other kind." "That doesn't mean you can even predict them, let alone set them up like that." Luminous intel reflected off the Major's bald head. "You'd have to know the starting condition of a million different variables to 10 decimal places. Literally." "Yep. Vampires can't even do that. Quantical computers can't do that." Spindle shrugged like a marionette. All the while, the gang had been slipping in and out of character, dancing with some unseen partner that, despite their best efforts, told us little beyond endless permutations of, "You really wouldn't like it here." Any interrogative it answered with another, yet somehow it always left the sense of questions answered. "Did you send the fireflies?" Sasha asked. "We send many things, many places," Rorschach replied. "What do their specs show?" "We do not know their specifications. The fireflies burned up over Earth." "Then shouldn't you be looking there? When our kids fly, they're on their own." Sasha muted the channel. "You know who we're talking to? Jesus of fucking Nazareth, that's who." Spindle looked at Bates. Bates shrugged, palms up. "You didn't get it?" Sasha shook her head. "That last exchange was the informational equivalent of, 'Should we render taxes unto Caesar, beat for beat?'" "Thanks for casting us as the Pharisees," Spindle grumbled. "Hey, if the Jew fits." Spindle rolled his eyes. "That's when I first noticed it. A tiny imperfection on Sasha's topology. A fly speck of doubt marring one of her facets." "We're not getting anywhere," she said. "Let's try a side door."
She winked out. Michelle reopened the outgoing line.
Theseus to Rorschach. Open to requests for information?
Cultural exchange, Rorschach said. That works for me. Bates's brow furrowed. Is that wise?
If it's not inclined to give information, maybe it would rather get some, and we could learn a great deal from the kind of questions it asks.
But tell us about home, Rorschach said. Sasha resurfaced just long enough to say, Relax, Major, nobody said we had to give it the right answers. The stain on the gang's topology had flickered when Michelle took over, but it hadn't disappeared. It grew slightly as Michelle described some hypothetical hometown in careful terms that mentioned no object smaller than a meter across. Consensus confirmed my guess, the hypothetical limit of Firefly eyesight. When Cruncher took a rare turn at the helm,
We don't all of us have parents or cousins. Some never did. Some come from vats.
I see. That's sad. That sounds so dehumanizing. The stain darkened and spread across his surface like an oil slick.
Takes too much on faith, Susan said a few moments later.
By the time Sasha had cycled back into Michelle, it was more than doubt, stronger than suspicion. It had become an insight, a dark little meme infecting each of that body's minds in turn. The gang was on the trail of something. They still weren't sure what. I was.
Tell me more about your cousins, Rorschach sent.
Our cousins lie about the family tree, Sasha replied. With nieces and nephews and Neanderthals. We do not like annoying cousins.
We'd like to know about this tree.
Sasha muted the channel and gave us a look that said, could it be any more obvious? It couldn't have parsed that. There were three linguistic ambiguities in there. It just ignored them.
Well, it asked for clarification, Bates pointed out.
It asked a follow-up question, different thing entirely. Bates was still out of the loop. Spindle was starting to get it, though. Subtle motion drew my eye. Saristi was back, floating above the bright topography on the table. The light show squirmed across his visor as he moved his head. I could feel his eyes behind it. And something else behind him. I couldn't tell what it was. I could point to nothing but a vague sense of something out of place somewhere in the background. Something over on the far side of the drums wasn't quite right. No, that wasn't it. Something nearer, something amiss somewhere along the drum's axis. But there was nothing there, nothing I could see. Just the naked pipes and conduits of the spinal bundle threading through empty space and... And suddenly, whatever had been wrong was right again. That was what finally locked my focus, the evaporation of some anomaly, a reversion to normalcy that caught my eye like a flicker of motion. I could see the exact spot along the bundle where the change had occurred. There was nothing out of place there now, but there had been. It was in my head, barely subliminal, an itch so close to the surface that I knew I could bring it back if I just concentrated. Sasha was talking to some alien artifact at the end of a laser beam. She was going on about familial relationships, both evolutionary and domestic. Neanderthal and Cro-Magnon and mother's cousins twice removed. She'd been doing it for hours now, and she had hours yet to go, but right now her chatter was distracting me. I tried to block her out and concentrate on the half-perceived image teasing my memory. I'd seen something there, just a moment ago. One of the conduits had had, yes, too many joints on one of the pipes. Something that should have been straight and smooth, but was somehow articulated instead. But not one of the pipes, I remembered, an extra pipe. An extra something, anyway, something bony. That was crazy. There was nothing there. We were half a light year from home, talking to unseen aliens about family reunions, and my eyes were playing tricks on me.
Have to talk to Spindle about that, if it happened again. A lull in the background chatter brought me back. Sasha had stopped talking. Darkened facets hung around her like a thundercloud. I pulled back the last thing she had sent. We usually find our nephews with telescopes. They are hard as hoblinites. More calculated ambiguity. And hoblinites wasn't even a word. Imminent decisions reflected in her eyes. Sasha was poised at the edge of a precipice, gauging the depth of dark waters below.
You haven't mentioned your father at all, Rorschach remarked.
That's true, Rorschach, Sasha admitted softly, taking a breath and stepping forward. So why don't you just suck my big, fat, hairy dick?
The drum fell instantly silent. Bates and Spindle stared, open-mouthed. Sasha killed the channel and turned to face us, grinning so widely I thought the top of her head would fall off.
Sasha, Bates breathed, are you crazy? So what if I am? Doesn't matter to that thing. It doesn't have a clue what I'm saying.
What?
It doesn't even have a clue what it's saying back, she added.
Wait a minute. You said Susan said they weren't parrots. They knew the rules. And there Susan was, melting to the fore. I did, and they do. But pattern matching doesn't equal comprehension. Bates shook her head. You're saying whatever we're talking to, it's not even intelligent?
Oh, it could be intelligent, certainly. But we're not talking to it in any meaningful sense.
So what is it? Voicemail?
Actually, Spindle said slowly, I think they call it a Chinese room.
About bloody time, I thought.
I knew all about Chinese rooms. I was one. I didn't even keep it a secret. I told anyone who was interested enough to ask. In hindsight, sometimes that was a mistake.
How can you possibly tell the rest of us what your bleeding edge is up to if you don't understand it yourself? Chelsea demanded back when things were good between us, before she got to know me. I shrugged. It's not my job to understand them. If I could, they wouldn't be very bleeding edge in the first place. I'm just a conduit.
Yeah, but how can you translate something if you don't understand it?
A common cry outside the field. People simply can't accept that patterns carry their own intelligence, quite apart from the semantic content that clings to their surfaces. If you manipulate the topology correctly, that content just comes along for the ride. You ever hear of the Chinese room? I asked. She shook her head.
Only vaguely. Really old, right?
100 years at least. It's a fallacy, really. It's an argument that supposedly puts the lie to Turing tests. You stick some guy in a closed room. Sheets with strange squiggles come in through a slot in the wall. He's got access to this huge database of squiggles just like it, and a bunch of rules to tell him how to put those squiggles together.
Grammar, Chelsea said. Syntax.
I nodded. The point is, though, he doesn't have any idea what the squiggles are or what information they might contain. He only knows that when he encounters squiggle delta, say, he's supposed to extract the 5th and 6th squiggles from file theta and put them together with another squiggle from gamma. So he builds this response string, puts it on a sheet, slides it back out the slot, and takes a nap until the next iteration. Repeat until the remains of the horse are well and thoroughly beaten.
So he's carrying on a conversation, Chelsea said. In Chinese, I assume, or they would have called it the Spanish Inquisition.
Exactly. Point being, you can use basic pattern matching algorithms to participate in a conversation without having any idea what you're saying. Depending on how good your rules are, you can pass a Turing test. You can be a wit and raconteur in a language you don't even speak. That's synthesis. Only the part that involves downscaling semiotic protocols, and only in principle. And I'm actually getting my input in Cantonese and replying in German, because I'm more of a conduit than a conversant. But you get the idea. How do you keep all the rules and protocols straight? There must be millions of them. It's like anything else. Once you learn the rules, you do it unconsciously. Like riding a bike or pinging the noosphere. You don't actively think about the protocols at all. You just imagine how your targets behave. A subtle half-smile played at the corner of her mouth. But the argument's not really a fallacy then, is it? It's spot on. You really don't understand Cantonese or German. The system understands. The whole room with all its parts. The guy who does the scribbling is just one component. You wouldn't expect a single neuron in your head to understand English, would you? Sometimes one's all I can spare. Chelsea shook her head. She wasn't going to let it go. I could see her sorting questions in order of priority. I could see them getting increasingly personal. To get back to the matter at hand, I said, preempting them all, you were going to show me how to do that thing with the fingers? A wicked grin wiped the questions right off her face. Oh, that's right. It's risky, getting involved. Too many confounds. Every tool in the shed goes dull and rusty the moment you get entangled with the system you're observing. Still serviceable in a pinch, though.
This ends Disc 3.